Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 142 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. Our guest this week was a key songwriter, guitarist, and driving force with the band Blondie, Chris Stein. Stein and his longtime musical and personal partner, frontwoman Debbie Harry, co-wrote many of Blondie's classic songs, including Ripper to Shreds, Heart of Glass, Dreaming, The Hardest Part, Rapture, and Island of Lost Souls. Stein also was the sole writer on such songs as Fade Away and Radiate and Sunday Girl from the 1978 breakthrough album Parallel Lines and Europa, the orchestral opening track of the band's blockbuster 1980 album Auto American. Stein played guitar, but he really liked playing around with tapes and sounds, and a sense of exploration pushed Blondie beyond its punk new wave roots into disco, funk, reggae, and rap. Stein has a new memoir out, Under a Rock, in which he chronicles his youth in Brooklyn, the formation, rise, fall, and eventual reunion of Blondie, and his battles with an autoimmune disease and a drug addiction that became harrowing and all-consuming. In our conversation, we dig into the details. What does he think is special about Debbie Harry's voice? How did they write songs together? How did Blondie fit into the CBGB scene of art, punk, and pop rockers? How did working with producer Richard Goddard on the first two Blondie albums, Blondie and Plastic Letters, differ from working with producer Mike Chapman on the ones that followed? Which is the one Blondie song that Stein knew would be a hit? How is it that the record label, Chrysalis, released a Buddy Holly cover as the lead U.S. single from Parallel Lines? Heart of Glass as the third single. What song and drum pattern did Stein have in mind before drummer Clem Burke turned in his explosive performance on Dreaming? What was the band's involvement on the American Gigolo smash Call Me? How is it that when Blondie turned in Auto American, Chrysalis complained that it contained no singles? The Tide is High and Rapture both hit number one. What's happening with Blondie's newly recorded as yet unreleased album? And how, after all he's been through, was Stein able to survive and continue his work as a musician, photographer, and writer? Blondie's stature has risen over the years because its innovative, undeniable music packs as much of a punch as when it was released. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Chris Stein. Do you listen mostly on vinyl or stream or what?
Yeah, streaming. Yeah. I have a huge record collection and no record player at this point.
How can that be?
I just don't, you know, I mean, unpopular opinion, vinyl, like film is a fetish at this point. I like seeing the album covers and having the tactile experience, but I don't have any problem with digital media.
Well, certainly in the studio, when everything converted from analog to digital, it became easier to cut together stuff.
I enjoy working with, I use Logic, the Apple program, for my musical stuff at this point. We just worked on an album now, foundation was digital. But on the preceding one, the prior record, Pollinator, we recorded on 24 tracks tape and then bounced it all onto digital.
What's the latest recording you've done?
We have a record in the can that's being mixed. It's been done for a while now, and I don't know if it's going to make it this year, next year for sure.
Who's putting it out?
BMG.
Oh, cool. What's it called?
I don't know yet. I'm not sure.
But it's all done.
Yeah, it's all done. Yeah, it's nice. It's good. Some stuff. There's some things I've wanted to record for a long time on it.
So how does that collaboration work at this point? Like, are you working at home writing stuff and everyone's kind of working on stuff and then you come together with each of your songs or
are Yeah. I mean, you know, we pulled in a couple of external songs. The last record was almost exclusively outside writers. That Pollinator record was I think there was three or four of the in-house songs from the band members, but this one is back to basics. There's, I think, only two or three covers songs
When did you actually start writing songs? I would love to hear a little more about sort of how you actually started playing guitar and writing songs.
Songwriting was came from screwing around with tape machines. And I mean, I was always dabbling in that. But then when I finally got a TIAC 4-track, if you remember those old machines.
Yeah, yeah.
That was my weapon of choice for many years. I really loved those things. And that's when I started. I don't know if writing songs is the right way to do it, but constructing songs, multi-layered things, you know.
So you weren't someone who was sitting there with your guitar, strumming chords and singing melodies over it. It was more of a working with technology kind of thing.
Yes. Yeah. The technology always drove the ideas.
As a guitarist, were you ever like a guitarist with a capital G? Like, oh, I want to be like this guitarist or that guitarist? Or was it really, again, more of a means to, you know, an end of creating these sounds that you wanted?
Well, I liked, you know, as I mentioned in the book, I liked the, you know, cultural exotic aspects of electric guitars that I was very attracted to when I was a kid. At first was probably just like the charisma of the electric guitar as an object and the amplifier all lit up and all that stuff was very attractive to me. But no, I never, you know, practiced and tried to shred or any of that stuff. The guys I liked and aspired to be like were more soulful and emotional, I guess, you know. I mean, Hendrix, I always loved Hendrix. And John Fahey was a huge inspiration for me.
Would you say that there's any sort of Chris Stein trademark guitar sound or approach?
Well, I play with finger picks all the time. So, I mean, that's unusual. I use the three finger claw hammer, as in the way you play a five-string banjo.
And do you remember the first song you actually wrote?
Nah, it was just like these instrumental things and stuff like that. I knew this kid when I was living in Manhattan and I had my 4-track. I was buddies with a guy who was a drummer. So I would go to his house in Brooklyn and play rhythm guitar and he would play drums. And then I would come back and put on two more tracks. So it was all semi-improvised stuff.
Right. And Heart of Glass was actually sort of an early one of yours. Like you were sort of demoing that way before you actually recorded it for Parallel Lines.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I made the bones of it after I had met Debbie. And you know, we kind of started writing songs out of necessity because it was just what you did then. Everybody was doing original material.
So, but that was something where, again, you were sort of messing with your tape machines and playing, you know, like playing with those disco beats at a time when, you know, maybe the CBGB sound wasn't quite so much going there.
Well, the disco aspect was added later on with Chapman. And initially it was, I don't know what the heck it was. It was, as I mentioned, it was kind of referencing Rock the Boat Baby by the Hughes Corporation.
Right.
Which was in the chorus a little bit. I mean, I don't know if you'd hear that if I didn't say it. It's just that a little bit of the swing, the way the guitar goes back and forth.
Well, and it's interesting too, because you don't necessarily associate the quote unquote punk scene with that sort of early mid 70s soul, but certainly that informed what you guys were doing and it gave it the swing that a lot of the other stuff didn't have.
Well, Blondie was always really diverse. You know, the Talking Heads and the Ramones had a narrower focus. I don't mean narrower in a bad way, but they had a kind of, certainly the Ramones had a kind of laser focus.
Right.
Stylistically. And we were just pulling these elements from all over the place, from girl groups and roots music and R&B, all this kind of stuff. And eventually that became part of the Blondie ethos or sound or whatever the heck it is.
Yeah, it was funny because like years later, and you mentioned this tour in the book, I saw Debbie Harry and you were in the band playing at the World Music Theater in Chicago, and there was Tom Tom Club and Jerry Harrison and the Ramones. So yeah, everyone you just mentioned was all on stage together in what, like 1992, something like that.
Escape from New York tour. That was really memorable and great. That was a nice moment.
But you could hear at that point how everyone had sort of diverged, and that the Ramones were doing the exact same thing they would have done in 1977. And, you know, everyone else was, you know, kind of veered in, you know, this dance direction, that dance direction, this sort of layered thing.
Yeah, Tom Tom Club were very much into roots music and world music.
So early in the days of Blondie, what was it like sort of getting the material together for an album, like those first few albums? Was there a lot of, would everyone sort of come in with songs, and then would they sort of have to jockey to get them in the final? Like, were a lot of songs left behind, or like, how did that all work out?
I don't know how many were not used. I mean, there were some songs that we never recorded that were pretty cool. But the first album particularly was just the set that we played frequently, and we kind of worked up to that point. The second album was a little more struggle to get material.
You mean that sort of like you have the lifetime to write the first album and a few minutes to write the second one?
Yeah, I guess that's what happens to people.
Well, and in that case, then you're not sort of like, wait, why aren't you using my song? It's like, hey, do you have a song? We need it.
There was always a struggle, because it was the band situation was kind of a democratic monarchical democracy, as they say. But
so who is the monarch?
Well, me and Debbie were in this kind of position because we had two votes. So but it was what it
so
was.
So you were the king and queen?
Somewhat. Not really. I mean, you know, with Jimmy, Clem, and Gary, everything was pretty somewhat democratic. We got ideas from everybody. Everybody put in a lot. Even, you know, Nigel and Frankie later on put in a tremendous amount of musical ideas.
You make it sound like there was a fair amount of contention throughout.
Yeah, of course. It was a big struggle, but I think that's what added to the success of the whole thing.
Right.
All the tension. I mean, you know, who are all those fucking bands that don't talk to each other for years but keep making records? You know, that goes on.
And what was mostly the source of the tension? Was it more personal, or was it musical, creative?
I think just quest for coming forwards, getting your material done, getting your musical parts done, etc. There was just a competitive nature with a bunch of, I don't know, you know, we were all in our 20s and 30s.
I mean, Blondie covered so much stylistic ground. And again, you came out of the quote-unquote punk scene, but you wouldn't listen to any of those songs and go, oh, that's so punk, now at least. But, you know, you're working...
There's some on the first two albums. My thesis is that the first two Rolling Stones albums are completely punk.
Right.
But nobody comes out and says that except me.
No, absolutely. The first two albums have elements like that. But it's also, you know, you've got Richard Goddard producing those records, and he has that kind of, you know, my boyfriend's back girl group sort of background and everything. You know, then you have, you know, you're hitting the disco floor with Heart of Glass. You're doing, you know, reggae later. You're doing funk and rap and all that. And, you know, in order to sort of go into all those different areas, and you're steering this pretty big boat with a lot of different people oaring, you know, paddling on it. Did people agree on all these different directions, or was it sort of like, this one wanted to do this, this one wanted to do that?
As they mentioned in the book, I wanted to record that Lerner and Lowe song from Camelot, and everybody thought I was completely fucking insane.
Right.
Which is the last song on the Auto American album.
But in general, was like one person, like, he's the rock guy and he's the more adventurous guy and you're the eclectic person? And did people have their own kind of...
Yeah, somewhat. I mean, Frankie was very rock and roll, Rolling Stones, Johnny Thunders oriented.
But was there like was there anything like where you guys had a big fight over this song? Like, oh, it's a good song, but it's not a Blondie song, or something like that?
No, I don't remember any big fights as such, but there was always the push-pull. I mean, it was always going on from day one.
Right.
It's funny because now, you know, it's a whole different, completely different dynamic when we're recording and working.
How is it different now?
It's just everybody wants to be professional and agreeable. It's just, you know, and Clem is the only other, you know, old-timer in the band at this point, so they have no choice. They must knuckle under. But everybody brings in ideas. You know, Matt, our keyboard player, gets his songs recorded. He's a good writer.
So, and you write in the book also about, you know, seeing Debbie singing with these other singers. What was it about her singing that stood out to you and, you know, eventually made you think, oh, this would be a great front person for this band?
Well, I was just really attracted to her. She was just immensely charismatic and gorgeous. So all those elements combined with her having a good voice.
Was there anything about the singing itself that struck you as unique? And did that develop over the years? Like you sort of, I mean, you could hear it in the records that she kind of becomes more powerful as she goes on.
Yeah, she has a, you know, vocal style. It's pretty specific. You know, there's a thing called miasma, melisma, you know, where the vocal
right
goes up and down a lot. She was always not in that vein. She's closer to a kind of Katy Perry breathy, straightforward delivery. I was actually very thankful when Katy Perry showed up and kind of put a damper on the fucking vocal acrobatics that had been her, you know.
That's so interesting. I hadn't thought of a connection between the two of them. But yeah, she's not like a singer with like all this vibrato on or any of that.
Yeah, she never did those acrobatics. She was just very delivered and I don't know if cut and dried, but she just and gave it her all. There's an element of acting also. She was always I don't know if musical theater is the right word, because it's more, I hope that what we did was more musical than what one sees in Broadway musicals and stuff. But she delivered, and the lyrics were always great. She's a great lyricist. I don't know if she gets enough credit for that stuff.
Well, in a sense, calling the band Blondie is sort of feeding into the sort of role-playing thing, because she dyed her hair, and then all of a sudden someone yelled, "Hey, Blondie," at her, and you guys have a band name. Yeah. But that also kind of gave you sort of an image like, well, I guess you're not going back to your regular hair color anymore.
Yeah, no, I mean, I just, you know, I don't know if Mick Jagger was a good-looking woman, that would have upped the separation between him and the band even more, possibly.
Do you think that naming the band Blondie sort of had some, I don't know, like how did that affect sort of the band itself in terms of your trajectory? Like if you, as opposed to calling yourselves like the, you know, the Shrubs or something, I don't know.
We had this affinity for comic books and grade B stuff, you know. It also was referencing that. I don't know how clear that is in the final analysis nowadays. But oddly, the people from the Blondie comics never gave us a hard time or anything. And I think Debbie met Penny Singleton once, who played Blondie in the movies.
Yeah, I think I would have, you know, I was the right age for it, that I would, when you guys came on the scene, I probably would have associated it a little bit with the comics. Better, yeah. It's a better band name than Dagwood or something like that.
Well, yeah.
And it did add to this thing where you had the Blondie as a band because people thought Debbie was Blondie.
Well, yeah, but that was, you know, that came 100% from our management. That was not a message that we wanted to put out there. Blondie is a band. We just wanted people to take it for granted and figure it out themselves. I always thought it was kind of an overstatement.
Yeah. Did having a woman fronting your band make you guys stick out or be apart a little bit from the CBGB's other bands that maybe were a little more...
Well, just everything in the fucking music scene, which was really a big boys club back then. I mean, nowadays, what do we got? Like 50% female, the music scene.
The biggest stars are women right now.
Yeah. So, you know, Debbie walked so all these girls could run, as they say. And there was a lot of resistance to her initially, especially in America. She did, you know, like... She did a press tour early on, and like we kept hearing that the journalists didn't want to be in a room with her because she was so dangerous, because she was a punk or whatever. But there was this whole weird misogyny that went on also.
Did you sense that when you were playing, you know, CBGB or Max's or, you know, those other clubs?
No, everybody was very, you know, that was a different environment, obviously, because it was a very incestuous relationship between the bands with each other and the fans, et cetera, especially early on.
And you write about going on tour with television and that not being the most harmonious relationship. Yeah. What was going on with that?
It's hard to say. You know, as I frequently say, there was like the art rock crowd and the pop rock crowd at CBGB's, and television were part of the art rock crowd, and we and the Ramones and Miami's and various others were part of the pop rock crowd. So there was a kind of a split in sensibilities.
So when you guys were on tour, that just kind of came out?
Yeah, you know, and just natural competition and us not really, nobody, including, you know, we were not used to doing any of that, dealing with other bands.
I liked it. I liked that you had your one really hot opening set and someone yelled, "Prove it, Tommy," at Verlaine afterwards.
I remember that, and it was mentioned in the British press somewhere.
Did they prove it?
I always thought they were fucking fantastic. We used to cover their songs. We've done, what did we do? See No Evil and Venus over right. the years. They were great. You know, I met Verlaine very early on when he first came to New York. Both Verlaine and Richard Hell told me that I auditioned for the Neon Boys, but I don't remember at all. But I was polite and told them, oh, yes, I did remember. But
you guys provided them a bassist.
Yeah, Fred went over to their camp, which was, I must have added to, you know, a little disharmony and contention.
Well, and I saw you guys toured with Rockpile too, and I'm like, oh, cool. And then it was like, but then they were sort of pulling some crap, or Jake Riviere was pulling some crap, and
yeah,
so that
well,
didn't
those
go.
Guys, by that time, that was later, and you know, those guys were kind of notorious. We maintained a friendship with Nick over the years.
Right. So tell me about writing songs with Debbie. I mean, you talked about her lyrics. Would you sort of come up with like a musical idea and then she would sort of start adding lyrics? Would you sort of figure out the music together based on like a little bit, or would you tend to do one?
There's a couple we did together, but generally I would give her a musical idea and she would embellish it. I mean, she added, even now on this new record, she adds a lot to the melodies and phrasing and that kind of stuff.
So like something like Dreaming, I think you wrote about this, how you'd come up with the phrase "Dreaming is free," and then she kind of ran with it.
She went with the rest of it. There's a couple of them like that I would give her a phrase. It's like, I always heard that Paul McCartney called Yesterday scrambled eggs or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, he dreamed it, supposedly.
Yeah. But yeah, there's a few like that. I mean, Sunday Girl I wrote in its entirety, but most of the stuff was embellished by Debbie.
Right, or like Fade Away and Radiate.
Yeah, that too. Yes, I wrote that in its entirety. I think that's about Debbie sleeping in front of the television.
Yeah, it's a great one. And then you got Robert Fripp on there too. So
Fripp is a great character. I mean, you know, we did a lot of stuff with him over the years.
I'm always sort of amused by, there's sort of that sense of like, you know, you record all this music and then there's the stuff that becomes big and the stuff that you think was going to become big that didn't become big. And maybe the stuff you didn't think was going to become big that did. Like, were you sort of surprised that the songs that were your hits were the songs that were your hits?
The only song I knew was going to be a hit was Tide Is High. That's the only one. The other ones were like, who knew?
Yet you wrote that Chrysalis came back to you when you turned in Auto American and said there are no singles on this record.
Yeah, for sure. Yes.
Except for the two that hit number one.
That's kind of their MO. You know, that's what record companies do. They're not known for their insight into the culture.
Well, like Parallel Lines. I mean, I'm Gonna Love You Too was a single. Picture This was a single. before yeah. Heart of Glass was a single. So they clearly heard different songs as having commercial potential than the one that actually was your big breakthrough hit.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm Gonna Love You Too, it was really intended as an album track. I never thought of that as a single.
And just a Buddy Holly cover. I mean, you have all these great originals, and then they're putting out the Buddy Holly cover first.
Yeah, I think there may have been some kind of a kickback with McCartney's publishing. McCartney owned the publishing. Right. So that may have been in the mix. I'm not really sure. It was also the same year there was a Buddy Holly movie, right?
The Buddy Holly story with Gary Busey.
Gary Busey. So I think they were trying to farm that a little bit. But Parallel Lines was on the charts for like months and months before they, in their wisdom, released Heart of Glass.
Now, did you think when you finished that album that Heart of Glass was like the quote unquote hit?
No, probably not. I don't know what I thought.
You know, you look at the album tracks and you're like, oh, Heart of Glass, One Way or Another, Hanging on the Telephone, which is a great cover. And those are the ones that you sort of, you know as like the famous songs from it. And the fact that they went with two other ones without having any idea that, like, no, you know, the more commercial songs are just sitting right there waiting for you to pull them out.
Yeah, no, I mean, Chapman wouldn't let the A&R guys have any say in anything. He was really kept them at bay. I mean, they would come to the sessions, but they wouldn't be able to open their mouths about, you know, what they thought, which was kind of great.
Were you thinking at the time, oh, they should release Heart of Glass as a single?
I this is a really good question. I don't know. I can't say.
Were you surprised when it became, you know, the hit that it was?
No, I don't know if I was surprised, because I'm always very optimistic. So there's that. But it was gratifying, certainly.
Yeah, because the album had been out for a while, and then finally it was like
6 months or something on the charts.
Yeah, I mean, back then when you listen to AM radio, you'd hear, you know, Chic, and then you'd hear Aerosmith or whatever. So it wasn't like so weird. Like now everything's so much more fragmented. But at the same time, it was this kind of crossover in a way that you didn't have a lot of those crossovers back then, coming from the, again, so-called punk new wave scene into, you know, the disco dance floor.
Yeah, no, I've never had a problem with disco music. I liked R&B and I liked disco music, and I was never part of the anti-disco movement.
Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, the new sponsor of this weekend's Pitchfork Music Festival in Chicago. Congratulations, Revolution. Revolution is Illinois' largest independent brewery and the maker of, among other great beers, the classic Antihero IPA and the premium lager Cold Time. On these scorching summer days, Cold Time really hits the spot. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's available in 12 packs of 12-ounce cans. So the first two albums, you know, Blondie and Plastic Letters, you had Richard Goddard as your producer, and then you moved on to Mike Chapman, you know, who had had all these huge, you know, hits earlier in the 70s with, like, The Sweet and all these, you know, these Mud. Great...
And I don't know if Susie had hits, but Mud had hits and all that stuff, yes.
So how was their approach different in the studio, and did you know... Did different stuff come out because of that? You know, because you're working with Mike Chapman?
Yeah, I mean, Goddard had an old school approach, almost like a jazz recording, where the band would go in and everybody would play at the same time and just try to do five or six takes and pick the best take and do a little overdubbing. And Chapman completely deconstructed everything. And a lot of those songs on Parallel Lines were pieced together with different parts not played simultaneously. And the band would play, we would all go in and play, but only record the bass and drums, say, on a track. And that would be what we were going for. It was a good bass and drums track, and then re-overdub all the guitars and keyboards. So that was the whole learning curve, and it was great. I mean, I went on to do a bunch of production myself, and I always carried the stuff I got from Chapman into it.
So you like that kind of breaking it up thing as opposed to the band playing live in the studio?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I came out of the, you know, as I said, I used to dabble with these four tracks, which was all involved with the layering. And I was always, even when I was a kid, I was always interested and curious about the bands I listened to, whatever the Beatles, Stones have, about the layering aspects and what one could do with that process. So I was happy to dive into it.
How did that work with the band dynamic? Did the band like working that way also, or like did some like it more than others?
I think it was, you know, some people may have felt more strained by the repetition. I'm not going to say Stanley Kubrick, but it was in that vein of doing, you know, 40, 50 takes of something occasionally.
It would be like 40, 50 takes of like just the drums or just the rhythm track?
Yeah, or just a, you know, guitar. The thing on Heart of Glass, the guitar that goes digga, 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 with the 16th notes.
Right. I mean,
that was done with a Roland tape echo machine, like a chorus echo or a space echo. And that took fucking hours just to get every one of those beats in time to Chapman's satisfaction.
Well, and Clem Burke is playing, you know, this part that, you know, later probably would have been done by a drum machine, but it has this real propulsion the way he's playing it. But I would imagine that would be
that the Heart of Glass drums were assembled the day we recorded the bass drum on its own, et cetera, the way they used to do disco tracks.
Interesting. Yeah, because I was going to say that it would seem like it would be tricky to get that all quite as in sync as it is. So, I mean, was he playing with a click track or was it just him?
Yeah, well, but everything was synced to the rhythm machine and synthesizer. And that was the big breakthrough, is that this was before MIDI. You know, people know what MIDI is, this digital language that the instruments use to speak to each other.
Right.
Musical instrument digital interface, MIDI. So this was before that. This was voltage controlled, but VCA it was called. And when at that point, being able to sync the Roland synthesizer and the Roland drum machine together was this big watershed moment in musical history.
Right. And you're not working with all these digital tracks. You're working with actual tracks on tape. So if you're recording separate bass drum track and this track, that means that you're working with like a lot of tracks that all have to be mixed together by person.
And it all has to be done in real time. There's no cut and paste at that point, you know.
And you're probably bouncing tracks around and also wanting it to still sound really bright, which it does. I mean, it doesn't sound like one of these muffly things where, you know, you've mixed it down so many times. I mean, it has.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we got to work at the height of analog before it became digital. Mike had the first, this digital reverb, which, oh man, I can't remember what it was. It was an early, that was the first piece of digital equipment in the studio. I don't even know if I guess it was on Parallel Lines. It was this giant box.
So Parallel Lines was a huge record, like critically acclaimed. People loved it. You know, the band's profile went way up. Did that change how you went into the studio to do Each of the Beat, which also was with Mike Chapman?
Yeah, Each of the Beat was a little bit looser. He didn't have us as locked into repetition. There was a little more spontaneity involved, but we, you know, everybody had matured to a certain extent by that point. We had been touring endlessly.
So Dreaming, which is the lead song and lead single, which was a single when it came out that I just loved and still love, you know, it's got this explosive Clem Burke drum performance on it with Debbie's dreamy vocals going on top of it. But he said later that, if I hadn't been, you know, that was just sort of a take for me to just sort of play around, and I didn't know they were going to use it. And if they'd used a more straight ahead drum pattern, it would have been a bigger hit. Like, do you agree with that?
Maybe at the time, but everybody loves that drum pattern at this point. It's hard to say. I saw Dreaming references Dancing Queen by ABBA.
Right. You know,
da, 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 da. That is definitely referenced in the chorus. I mean, I was thinking of it. So I was probably looking for a heavier four on the floor thing, which is probably in there, but it's combined with all the toms and stuff.
So did you know he was going to play it that way?
No, I don't know. He just went for it.
But it's because it sounds like, again, it sounds like there are maybe like different takes, and Chapman just went with the one that he didn't realize, Clem didn't realize was going to be like, oh, I thought I was just kind of doing that for fun. But yeah, did you guys like argue over like the mixes or something? Like, were you like, hey, no, I want this to sound more like Dancing Queen, Mike?
No. I had a lot of faith in Mike. I mean, you know, he delivered always.
Then Hardest Part, which is the second song on there and another single, like that song just totally kicks, I think. Is that a song you thought would have been a bigger hit? Like, again.
Yeah, I was trying to do this kind of metal edge, whatever the heck it is, you know, funk metal thing. So maybe that predates a lot of stuff.
Because it has that thing where like the verses are very rock, and then the, you know, the choruses are slipping more into that, you know, disco-y Heart of Glass thing.
I mean, I thought everything was going to be a hit probably. Because I was an egomaniac, and again, I'm optimistic.
Is there one of those albums that you think of as like the one that sort of captures you guys at your peak?
Kind of Auto American, because that really was, you know, and it was this grand fucking thing, right, with the orchestra.
Yeah, you got your big orchestral introduction to it.
All these people are on it, you know. Tom Scott is playing horn, and Ray Brown plays bass on it, and Flo and Eddie are singing on it. It's this whole thing. There were guys in the orchestra there was a bass player in the orchestra who told me he played on the Lawrence of Arabia soundtrack, which just was like, head explodes. Because when I was a kid, I used to play that soundtrack. I was listening to, you know, Jar before I was listening to the Beatles.
Yeah, that's great. And the one that you knew was going to be the hit was The Tide Is High. And yet,
yeah, absolutely.
As you wrote in the book, when you turned in the album, Chrysalis was like, oh, there are no singles on this record.
Yeah, again, that was kind of their MO. I'm sure I'm not the only one to turn in a record and hear that from a record company. I feel like that's kind of standard operating procedure.
Well, I'm glad they didn't make you sort of tear it up and go back to the drawing board or something.
Well, Chapman wouldn't stand for it. He probably just said, no, fuck you. This is and they really had no power over Mike. Mike is involved with something like 70 number one hits, something insane like that.
Well, they couldn't have been unhappy when The Tide Is High took off.
Yeah.
And did you always know that Rapture would be a single, or, you know, did you sort of think of that as like, oh yeah.
I suspected. I mean, I really liked the way all those tracks came out. Tom Scott did all those horns in like 2 hours. That's all just one guy. So that's kind of amazing.
Wow. Right? Yeah. And then the rap on there, was that you were sort of the one into sci-fi? Did you and Debbie work on the rap together?
We both added to it. I had this foundation for it, and Debbie added to it. But, I've heard her say frequently that she would have liked to work on. Chapman was so happy with the early takes that he just went with it.
She wanted to like make it a little more street or something.
I don't know about street. I think she just would have liked to have worked on it more, but it has its charm.
Oh yeah. No, so the structure of that song, Ollie, was always was that kind of, you know, sort of the dreamy dancey part. And then the rap part.
Yeah. Yeah. There weren't a lot of rap songs as such at that point.
No.
That had a chorus, you know, they were kind of a single groove all the way through.
Well, and then you wrote about how these like hip hop guys later were saying, oh, the first hip hop song I ever heard was Rapture.
Yeah, both people from Mobb Deep and Wu-Tang both told me that, which is kind of mind blowing.
When you recorded Auto American, had Call Me already come out? Because that was sort of the one-off you did with Giorgio Moroder for American Gigolo.
Oh man, that's another good question. I don't know the timeline on that. It might have been a little bit after. I'm not sure though. Gee, I don't know.
I think Call Me came out before that album came out.
Yeah, maybe so, yeah.
And you're not actually playing on that, right? Like it's like his guys.
I don't know. The ideas are all us, but Giorgio was not anything like Chapman where he would sit and, handhold us to repetition. He just wanted to get it all done. So we did takes of it. Like the guitar part. I mean, that's definitely Frankie, but I'm not sure if that's Frankie playing. I think it's all Giorgio's guys. Drums are Clem. He's on there for sure.
So Clem's the drummer on the release track?
Yeah, pretty sure, yeah.
So you guys did record it, but then he just sort of went back and did his own.
Yeah, he just redid the parts, yeah.
How much of a difference did that song make in your career?
That's the biggest Blondie song. That's what everybody knows. And we got to hang around with Paul Schrader. So that was awesome. And Richard Gere.
Right. Yeah, no, you write about how Schrader turned into one of your favorite, or was one of your favorite, still is one of your favorite filmmakers. So
yeah, he's great. Yeah, yeah, the Mishima movie is Godhead. Yeah,
absolutely. And then you sort of split off and did the Cuckoo record with Nile Rodgers and Bernard Edwards. Did the others in the band go, wait, why is she doing a solo record? Or was that sort of
mine? You know, we had met Nile a while prior to that, and it turned out he was a big rock and roll fan, and he loved us, and Devo, he particularly loved.
Who were on the record.
Yeah. I've seen Nile say that he wasn't really aware that Good Times was used as a hip-hop foundational track, you know, that we were the ones who showed him that. Hmm. So who knows?
How much of a, I don't know, like kind of a mind-expanding experience was it sort of working with other musicians and these other, you know, producers coming from this different world?
Yeah, it was different. We kind of split it down the middle, but it was all those guys' band that I played a little guitar on there. Nile was great. It's, you know, Bernard was great. I was always a big Chic proponent.
Sure. Those records sound great. They really sound, they continue to sound really good. Like I'll go back and like, I was not buying like Chic records at the time, but I've gone back and gotten those like first few albums because I'm like, oh no, those are really good.
Yeah. They're super modern and minimalist. They're terrific recordings, all of those things.
Yeah. Like when Another One Bites the Dust was a hit, I'm just like, that's just, it's Good Times. It's just like, it's a good version of Good Times, but, again, you're in Blondie. Blondie's kind of at its peak, and then Debbie goes and does the solo record that you're obviously still involved in. Did that cause ripples within the band?
Not that I can think of. I can't remember anybody complaining about it as such.
And you came back and did The Hunter.
Hunter, yeah. Hunter has some really good stuff on it. The cover sucks. part of the... I think I always.
It's not the best cover. I'm going to agree with you on that. If I'm allowed to say that, it's okay.
No, I always think if it had a better cover, it would have been more successful.
And the James Bond movie should have taken For Your Eyes Only too, right?
I like the other version a lot.
The Sheena Easton.
Yeah, Sheena. Right. Yes, that's a great track. So I, you know, that was a little more contemporary. We were doing this old school version, and I don't know if they even considered it much at that point. So I don't, you know, that's, we just heard they were looking for a track during.
You went in to write a James Bond song when.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
That
on James Bond, everybody, James Bond was a stylistic element in all the way the boys dressed. All that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I guess when the movie came out, you could have just put it out like, well, here's the James Bond song for real. Here's the theme song. Just don't listen for it in the movie.
Yeah, that kind of stuff didn't go on in those days, but yes.
Exactly. Well, so with The Hunter, which didn't do as well, I mean, were you as happy with that album overall?
It was okay. It has a lot of nice stuff on it. There's no just full-on hard rock tracks as such. They're all a little bit experimental. The Island of Lost Souls track,
that was the single.
Has those great horns on it, but it came out in the UK at the same time as the Falklands was going on.
Right.
Little war with what, Argentina, is that? And they decided this song was somehow about the Falklands conflict, which was, we never intended it to be. So
being in New York, you weren't all consumed by the Falklands conflict at the time you're making that record. So
yeah, it was not much of a, it was, as wars go, it was small.
So in the book, the narrative basically goes from The Hunter into, you know, these health problems that you're dealing with and sort of the descent into addiction as well. I mean, and you don't really mention kind of like that was the last Blondie record until you regrouped in what, 1999 for No Exit is when that came out at least. Was there ever actually like a breakup of Blondie, or did it just kind of
just
never get back to each other?
Yeah, it just dissolved and people stopped calling each other, etc.
And it was, again, you had this Pemphigus. I want to see if I could pronounce it right. Pemphigus?
That's Latin for blisters.
Yeah, it sounded awful.
Yeah, it's a shitty name. I always wished it had a better name.
Yeah, you got to come up with a new name for it. Pemphigus, and you lost like a ton of weight, but yeah, it was also around the time you were like, you know, becoming addicted to heroin. I mean,
yeah, it was all exacerbated by drug use, which was wrecked by immune system. So combined, the condition I got was genetic, but definitely came from immune deficiencies.
Yeah. So how did you sort of pull out of it? And then when you read the book, it's pretty harrowing for a while because there's, you know, you sort of get through that part, but then there's still heroin and then there's methadone and there's cocaine and everything else. How are you here right now?
Well, now I haven't done anything for like 25 years. I've been sober. So, and I was never an alcohol person. So I don't know. I just maintain. I mean, it's taken a toll on my health. And generally, I mean, I'm sure if I didn't do all that crap in those early years, I would be in better shape now. I had various, I have an odd heartbeat, you know, irregular heartbeat, AFib.
Right.
Not uncommon. But I wonder if that was helped along by doing lots of cocaine over the years.
What made you able to finally get out of it? Because you were pretty deep into it for a while.
I just, after a while, it's just, you know, as that shit is, it's all diminishing returns and you just start feeling worse and worse and getting crazier and crazier. And then during that, when I was, you know, I started finally seeing a therapist and was on the methadone program. And then around that time, I met my wife, who I've been married to for 25 years, and she's been great and supportive. And that's just it.
How much, you know, did sort of getting back into music was... I mean, the fact that you were sort of making more music as of the late 90s into the 2000s, was that sort of a sign of you being in sort of better shape or?
Yeah, to a certain extent. Yeah, I felt like it was a struggle. I mean, I just took a while. But towards the end, my biggest demon was smoking cocaine. I don't know if you want to call it crack or freebase. And that stuff just is bad news. And after a while, it's not, you know, you just are doing it to not feel exhausted and fatigued, but at the same time, it's making you crazy and psychotic.
Right.
So it's just not something you can sustain.
Whenever this album comes out, is Blondie going to tour again? And are you going to be in the touring version of it?
Writing it off. But I also had fucking prostate cancer and radiation therapy and all that nonsense too. I'm pretty much at the tail end of that. My numbers are almost zero. I should be okay, I think. But I'm not writing off touring, but the touring is exhausting. And I really, after 50 years, I don't miss airports and hotels. So, you know, when we started out, airports were kind of glamorous back in the 60s and 70s.
Right.
Little exciting, and now it's just like going on the fucking subway. So
does Debbie still want a tour?
Yeah, she's doing it. She enjoys it. I mean, she gets there's a feedback loop with the audience, and that's very invigorating. And the shows are great. That's the good part of it.
Yeah. And when you're working on this latest album, were you still sort of, you know, giving Debbie musical ideas that she'd write was that relationship the same, or did it change the structure of it at all?
Yeah, it's the same. I was all involved with the record. John Congleton is great producer. We did the last one with him. He's great. I enjoy working with him. I had a lot of input.
And writing the book, writing Under a Rock, like you've actually had a couple other books, but this is like the memoir where you really talk about everything.
Yeah.
What prompted you to write it, and how did writing it maybe change your perspective on everything that had come before?
It's, you know, it makes everything more of a totality, perhaps. I am kind of a time as a flat circle guy. So that... I enjoy writing. I always am doing some kind of writing here and there, even if it's just social media bullshit. I liked it. It was good. I did extensive captioning on my photo books, and this came out of that. And I just wanted to get it all down while I still had the memories and brain cells and was able to.
And you worked without a collaborator. You wrote this,
Yeah, no, I totally wrote it myself and did several passes. It was a long process, but I really liked doing it.
Did you have like sort of a 600 page version of it that you had to cut down, or was this really the book that you wrote?
No, that's pretty much it. I just kept going and going and until it reached a logical conclusion somewhat.
Was there anything in there that, again, sort of changed your perspective at all on stuff like that? Oh, you know what? This really was a sort of a pivotal thing that I hadn't really realized until I'd sort of put it into words like this.
Well, the addiction stuff, I didn't realize how all consuming that was because I was always dealing with it. Certainly, you know, when in the early days when I was just smoking lots of pot constantly, I didn't consider it any kind of addiction really. And that all became a perspective a little more.
Well, and when you're reading through it too, you know, there are just all these, especially for someone who doesn't know everyone like you do, there are a lot of these characters who are very colorful, who are coming in and out, and a lot of them are not coming to like very good ends. And it's sort of like, oh, you know, this is like a pretty grim scene at times, and just like stuff with, you know, like seeing someone who's been shot in the head and people dying of, you know, this, that, you know, AIDS and drugs and everything else. So it's like, on one hand, you have this very glamorous rock star existence where you have, you know, Bowie and Iggy Pop and Mick Jagger coming over. And then on the other hand, there's this just like really tough stuff that you're dealing with at the same time.
Yeah, no, well, I was aware of juxtaposing these up and downs as I was writing.
I was really sorry because I hadn't seen this at the time. I was really sorry to read about your daughter.
Yeah, no, it was rough.
That's no, as a father of two girls, I mean, that's just heartbreaking, and I'm really sorry.
That's like the worst thing I've had to deal with. It's been a year now, but you know, there's 100 to 200 people a day being killed by this stuff. So I don't know. I don't know how to get the message out. I talked to a lot of people about this. It's just a lot of money in this stuff. I don't know how much the law enforcement is following the money, but I have a feeling it goes much deeper into our society, our culture, than given credit for. It's not just street level drug people.
Something. No, it's an epidemic.
Higher up people are making a lot of money from this.
Well, that's awful. But anyway, but I was sorry, obviously, about that. In terms of sort of what you're doing now, like you're waiting for this record to come out, like what's your day like? Do you have the sort of like schedule you adhere to every day? Do you have like a time where you sort of go off and, you know, do some writing, do some reading? Do you have another project that you're working on?
I gotta get back to working on music is my main focus at this point. I just haven't been doing music during the whole book situation. But and I've just been doing a lot of this kind of interface with the public and media about the book, which is nice.
Kibitzing.
Yeah.
When you're working on music, do you need to sort of set aside time with your little machines to like, okay, now I'm going to write? Or is it something where you'll be walking around and you'll get like a little hook in your head and you think, oh, I better sing this into my voice memo or something like that?
A little of both. I'm not a very regulated person. I just am kind of free form. But yeah, a little bit of both.
Do you still have any, you know, goals you're working toward at this point?
Yeah, I'd like to get, as far as the band thing, I'd like to, we're always hearing about film projects and TV projects and trying to get that stuff off the ground, but it's a really slow process.
Like a movie about Blondie?
Yeah, something, yes, whatever it might be.
Broadway jukebox musical?
Yeah, I don't know about that. But people are always taking shots at that. I'm not a big musical theater person.
It seems like for everyone that works, there are about five that don't, which isn't to say it's not as a bad idea, but it just seems like it's a, you know, at this point, that formula is a little bit tricky.
You know, I'm a big movie guy, so I'm more inclined in that direction.
Are there any movie biopics that you especially admire?
Yeah, Inside Llewyn Davis.
Oh, that's a good one.
I don't really have a lot of favorite music movies. Most music movies are terrible. I have like three or four, and none of them are like performance. You know, the Donald Camel, Dick Rogue,
right?
That's great. I consider that a music movie. And Spinal Tap, of course, and Frank.
Classic.
You know, Frank, what the heck is his name? The with Fassbinder. It's the John Ronson story.
Oh, okay. I do not know that movie. No.
Oh, it's wonderful. That, because it really, in spite of it being surreal and odd, it really shows off band dynamics.
Yeah. I like Love and Mercy also. The Brian Wilson one.
Yeah, no, that's, I like the Queen one and all that stuff. None of that works for me.
The Queen one drove me crazy because it was so not at all representative of what really happened. It was like, wait a minute, they're putting out Fat Bottom Girls before Bohemian Rhapsody? I don't think so.
You could have just plugged any band into that scenario and it would have been the same movie too. It was just very, you know, tropey.
Yeah, that one drove me nuts. So what would yours be like? Would it, and who would play you guys?
I don't know.
Do you ever think to yourself, oh, you know, this is who should play me and this is who should play Debbie?
Yeah, sure. My wife has always thought about it. I don't know. It's difficult. We've had a lot of discussions and a lot of people have asked about playing Debbie and big names, small names, etc.
One of the great things in Llewyn Davis, by the way, which would also have to go in the Blondie movie, Cat. Good cat movie.
Yeah, no, we have four cats now. My daughter wants a fifth cat, which is pretty insane. So we're still trying to keep her back from that. We have four cats and three dogs in Manhattan. It's crazy.
When you mentioned having a cat named Sunday, was it Sunday Man?
Yeah,
it was. Yeah, and when I read that, you know, Sunday Girl was written about, I was like, that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah. Yes, he was. Yeah, well, he was part of it. But yes, I mean, it also references Georgie Girl a little.
Right. When you were recording all this music at the time, did you have any sense of sort of the position and culture that, you know, Blondie would have at this point?
No, that's like the eternal question. Everybody at CBGB is, you know, did you think about 40 years hence? And I don't think anybody was. Everybody was very much in the moment anyway.
Yeah, it's always interesting, sort of the stuff that sticks and the songs that stick and everything else. But yeah, I mean, like, I hate the word iconic, I really do, but like Blondie has a sort of iconic position in culture right now. You know, they just, you guys made it, and you know, you represent something, and it's cool that you're still doing it. And I look forward to hearing the new record, whatever you end up calling it.
Yeah, I don't know what it's called yet. I really don't. We had a couple of working titles, but nothing's been finalized. And again, we were really lucky with that stuff to hook up with Mike Chapman, because it all sounds. It doesn't sound dated. You listen to stuff from the 70s and 80s, and it's frequently easy to identify the sonic nature of it and go, oh, that sounds like that, period. And something like Heart of Glass just sounds like stuff you hear all the time now in the modern world.
Yeah, really all the way through those records, there isn't, like, you don't have those kind of timestamp things that you do on like a lot of those big gated synthy drums in the 80s and late 70s and that sort of thing. No, it sounds great. It was fun to re-listen to it, but in prepping to talk to you. So thank you for that. Thanks so much. I really appreciate you coming on and talking with me. It's been a pleasure listening, hearing your music all that time, and then getting to know you better reading Under a Rock. Well, thanks. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I hope to see you in person sometime. And
thanks for your support, man, really.
That's it for episode 142 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Chris Stein for making such timeless, powerful music and for sharing his story with us. Stein's memoir, Under a Rock, is out now from St. Martin's Press, and it includes beautiful presentations of his stunning photos as well as the story of his life. Follow Chris Stein on Instagram at Chris Stein, 1S, and on Twitter X at Chris Stein Plays. Go to blondie.net for the band's upcoming tour dates, although Stein isn't playing with them right now. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who, coincidentally, also only eats guitars. Get up! For mere $24, you could become a Carol Pop friend and help keep this thing going. Please contribute at carolpop.com. Your support is much appreciated. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Carol Pop on Twitter, X, and Instagram at Carol Popcast. And you can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop Conversation. Thanks.